Good. Yeah, I bring greetings from Reading, Tylos in Reading. There are a number of connections, as has been mentioned, between us, and it's my delight really to be back with you. It's been a couple of years since I was last here, and even more since I was able to bring my wife. We just had our eldest girl, Thea. She was weeks old. It was probably about this time 4 years ago that we were all able to come as a family. So this was the first time. I remember it was the first time. She was a weeks old. She's not going to remember. But the first time she saw the sea, for example. So we remember that. It was important for us. And now we've got another boy. He's two now. So that's what happens, isn't it? They grow up and they get older and time goes and we all get a bit grayer and we, you know, tired and all the rest of it. But nevertheless, we are so pleased to be with you again today and to be able to minister together with you. Do have your Bibles open then to Exodus 15. We're going to dip in and out of it today. The story of Exodus. We were listening in the car on the way up here to the Prince of Egypt soundtrack. Have you seen that film? Yeah, I think it's a fantastic film. I think it's a great animation. The music is brilliant. Even just listening to the music in the car, it's stirring because it is this epic story. That's the story of Exodus. It is this amazing, epic story of God saving his people out of slavery in Egypt under a guy called Moses. Moses. It happened about 1,500 years before Jesus. If you're not quite sure how it all works out, this is now before, way before Jesus. You know, even Peter Jackson could make, I think, of four, five, six films, many films as he wants to really capture the essence of what this story is like, this epic story. God rescuing people from Egypt. It's called Exodus as they exit Egypt and head to the promised land, a land God had sworn he would give them, their own land. They would be their own nation in years to come. Now, in between that, though, between being freed from slavery in Egypt and actually getting there to the promised land, there's a wilderness. There's a desert they've got to cross. And here in this desert, they're going to face new challenges, new temptations. And the big question is, having seen God save them from Egypt, will they trust and obey him to get them through the desert? They'd seen God save them. Will he get them through this desert now? And the story of Exodus, you might think, well, happened a long time ago. That's all nice. They made a good film out of it. But why is it important to us? What's it got to do with us today? Well, two big reasons, I think, at least. Firstly, because Exodus is a kind of a prototype, a kind of a model of our salvation. A greater salvation through Jesus Christ himself. It points forward in the Bible to how Jesus saves us from slavery to sin and death. But secondly, it's important because, as the Apostle Paul says himself in 1 Corinthians chapter 10 in the New Testament, the Hebrews in the wilderness are an example to us of what it means to follow Jesus. We can learn a lot as we look at them. If we're Christians, we've been freed from slavery to sin, but we're not in the promised land yet. Heaven, the new creation. We're not there yet. This is a wilderness. This is a desert. We're not there yet. So this morning, and then tonight as well, I want us to look at some of Israel's experience in the wilderness and learn what it means for us to be disciples in the desert, followers of Jesus in the desert. So this morning we're going to see what it means to trust and obey God who provides. And then this evening we'll look at how we trust and obey God who can fully satisfy us. So we pick up the story in chapter 15, and the people are just days into their new freedom. Just 3 days into their brand new life as the free people of God. And here they hit the first snag. They've crossed the Red Sea, and now they hit their first snag. They're thirsty. They're thirsty. And that's a big deal in a desert, isn't it? You need water in a desert. We're told in verse 23 that they did find water, chapter 15, verse 23, but it was bitter, it was undrinkable. I mean, how frustrating must that have been? You're hot, you're sweaty, you're tired, your mouth is dry, and there's this lovely, cool, refreshing pool of water, but you can't drink it. They call it Marah, that place called Marah, which means bitter. Probably because not only because the water was bitter, but they probably felt quite bitter about it as well. So what are they going to do? They've just seen God miraculously deliver them from slavery. In fact, he literally parted the waters of the Red Sea so that they could cross on dry ground and escape Egypt forever. So will he not now also rescue them from thirst? Do they have any reason to doubt that? Well, verse 24 tells us what happened. So the people grumbled against Moses, saying, "What are we to drink?" The people grumble. And so begins a pattern we see over and over again. A grumbling, complaining people. For 40 years it goes on. They grumble again. Chapter 16, verse 2. A couple of months later, they want food. So look at verse 2, chapter 16, verse 2 with me. In the desert, the whole community grumbled against Moses and Aaron. The Israelites said to them, "If only we had died by the Lord's hand in Egypt." We're talking about melodramatic. "There we sat around pots of meat." I don't know if you've got pots of meat at home. "But there we sat around pots of meat and ate all the food we wanted, but you have brought us out into this desert to starve this entire assembly to death." I mean, can you believe what they're saying? Instead of being delivered from slavery, they wish God had killed them. They'd been praying for 400 years that God would save them, and when he finally does it, they wish they could go back. Instead of freedom, they want to be slaves again in Egypt. They've conveniently forgotten all their bitter labor as slaves under cruel Pharaoh. All they can think about is their empty belly. They're complaining. They're a grumbling people. Now, there's a good complaining and a bad complaining, I think. A good complaining, I suppose, would be more like a lament, perhaps. We see that things aren't right in the world. There's evil and brokenness, and we are longing for God to fix it. Maybe we see that in our own lives or the world around us and that kind of complaining. But there's a bad kind of complaining, too, which is all about you. How your life, your day has been inconvenienced by something. How your wants and needs aren't being met like you want them to. We like to control things in life, don't we? We hate it when things don't go our way. We especially hate the feeling of not being able to do anything to change our circumstances. And so when life isn't going our way, when we feel we've lost control, we grumble. Well, I do. When we're stuck in traffic while we're trying to get to work. When the kids aren't doing what you want them to do. When the boiler breaks down for a third time this month and you need to call the engineer again. When the food you ordered isn't quite what you ordered. When the doctor phones again and with bad news, or your husband lets you down. We complain. These things out of our control that inconvenience our lives and make life difficult for us. Our feeling of not being in control leads us to complain, even against the God who saved us. The Hebrews are in a desert. They are living in tents. They're thirsty. They're hungry. And it's entirely out of their control. And so they complain. "God, what's going on here? What are you doing? Is this your plan? Is this it?" But for Israel, their complaining was rooted in something else as well, wasn't it? In unbelief. In unbelief. They simply don't trust God. The God who just saved them, they don't trust him then to also provide for them. So when we realize we're not in control, and if we don't trust the God who is in control, then you and I are prone to grumble too. We can learn that straight out of Exodus. So how does God respond to this then? How does he respond to their grumbling? He provides. He provides. Chapter 15, 25. Moses, on behalf of the people, cries out to God, and then God provides for them some wood, which miraculously cleanses the water, makes it drinkable. Then in chapter 16, God rains down bread from heaven in verse 4. Can you imagine that? Would you like to taste bread made in the kitchens of heaven? Wouldn't you? Divine bread. You know it's going to be good. In fact, this bread is so unique, so different to anything they've ever tasted before, that the only response they have is, what is it? That's what they say. What is it? Manna. What is it? That's what it means. And it gives them meat too. They wanted meat. He gives them meat. Quail, which is a type of small bird. It still flocks in that part of the world as well. They wanted meat, so they get it fresh every day. They don't have to do anything. Notice that. They don't have to do anything. No tilling the soil, no trying to dig a well. God provides it all. Clean water, bread every morning, meat every night. God is so gracious to them that despite their distrust, despite their complaining, having seen him just deliver them from Egypt in the most miraculous way, in his love, he meets their needs. He provides for them, even in a desert. So we can see already, can't we? We can see the lessons that Paul says we can learn from the people of Israel in the desert. Following Jesus is like living in a desert sometimes. We're not home yet. And we're facing trials and tribulations of various kinds. We're faced with many needs in our lives, from the big things to the small things. Sand between your toes, even. And so, like Israel, we need to trust and obey God in the desert. Trust he can lead us through this life and provide for every need. So here's what we're going to do in the rest of our time. I want to look at this event through the lens of another verse in the Bible. Deuteronomy chapter 8, verse 3, which I think gives us a very helpful interpretation of what these events mean. It was written sometime later by Moses, looking back, reflecting on what's gone on. Here's the verse. I'll put it on the screen there. It says this: God humbled you, causing you to hunger and then feeding you with manna, which neither you nor your fathers had known, to teach you that man does not live by bread alone, but on every word that comes from the mouth of God or the Lord. Three things I think this verse helps us. As we look at this event through this lens, three things I think it can reveal to us in Exodus 15 and 16. Firstly, it's teaching us something. It's teaching us to trust that God is God. Trust that God is God. Look at verse 3 again. Deuteronomy 8, verse 3. God humbles you, causing you to hunger. See, an important question we might ask about this story is, why does God bring his people into the desert in the first place? Why does God allow his people to thirst and hunger? Why does he let it get all the way to that point so that they're thirsty and hungry? Why does he let them get to that point of need? Why does God do that to you? Why does it sometimes feel like he's dragging you through this desert we call life? Why do we face so many trials and temptations? Why do you feel, I'm supposed to be a child of God here. Why do I feel need? Why do I feel desperate sometimes? Why do I feel like I can't do anything more? Why does God bring us to that place of total need? Well, Deuteronomy 8:3 says, to humble us. To humble us. To show us that God is God, not us. Remember, we complain and grumble when we realize life is out of our control. But it was never in our control in the first place, was it? We want control of our lives and our circumstances and our needs because, well, that's the sinful nature. It's always been there. That's our tendency as human beings. We want to be God. We don't want God. We want to be God. And so God sometimes causes us to thirst and hunger in order to show us we aren't in control and that he is God, not us. At least three times in chapter 16, verse 6, verse 8 and 11, we read that God allows this to happen so that they, it says, will know that I am the Lord, your God, who brought you out of Egypt. This is happening to you, Israel, so that you know something, that I am God and you aren't. I am the Lord. I am your God. I am your provider. It's in verse 7 and verse 10. Notice verse 10, Exodus 16. They looked towards the desert, and there was the glory of the Lord appearing in the cloud. Right there in the desert, in their moment of need, as God is providing for him, they saw the glory of God. It is a revelation of God, of his presence to bless and provide for them. They saw God. God is God, not them. You know, sometimes we can be so focused on the problems in our lives that we lose perspective. Our problems look so big and so scary. And you can imagine that in the desert, you're hungry, you're thirsty. I get hangry, all right? I know that feeling. I can't concentrate on anything until I've had something to eat and I feel a lot better, right? It can be consuming. But that's what happens in life. We look at the problems and away from God, we focus on the problem instead of the provider. God is God. And through this, he's wanting them to look to him. See me. I am the Lord. Look at my glory. Look at me, not your problem. Lift up your eyes. See his power. And sometimes that means he has to humble us. He lets the trials of the desert come so that we would lift up our eyes to him again and see his glory and power. That's what discipleship in the desert is for. It teaches us Jesus is Lord. He's the shepherd, not us. You may remember on one occasion Jesus was with his disciples in a boat, wasn't he? And a storm wells up. And the disciples are terrified. They think they're going to die. Have you ever thought you're going to die? They think they're going to die. And Jesus is asleep in that boat. And so the disciples, thinking they're about to die, they go to Jesus. And what do? Well, they do just as their ancestors do. They complain. Jesus, don't you care? Can't you see we're going to die? Don't you care if we drown? And it says Jesus got up, calms the storm with a word, and then he turns to them and says this, why are you so afraid? Do you still have no faith? Don't you trust in who I am? In other words, I am God the Son. I've got this. I'm with you. I do care. I will get you through this storm, as it were, this desert you call life. Trust me. The desert teaches us that God is God. Jesus is Lord. And we can trust him. There's a second thing it teaches us. It teaches us, as suspense is growing, it teaches us to trust that God provides. Trust that God provides. Deuteronomy 8, verse 3. Look at there again with me. God humbled you, causing you to hunger, and then feeding you with manna, which neither you nor your fathers had known. God miraculously, wonderfully provides water and food for his people in the desert. And in so doing, he's proving to them that he's the provider. And he's teaching them in that to trust in him. We've got a girl in our church. Oh, well done, guys. Thanks. We've got a girl in our church. She loves animals. And she found some abandoned, I think they're abandoned bunnies, little bunnies. And she's got resources. So she tuck them in, tuck them home, and started to raise them and feed them, get them ready to go back in the wild. And it got to the point, every time she walked in the room or wherever she kept them, they would see her and they would perk up because here comes, well, food, right? They were looking to her now to provide. They saw her as that provider. This is just what it's like here, that God is teaching, I'll provide for you. Look to me, look to me, look to me. Did you notice, though, they couldn't keep the bread overnight? It would rot away, verse 20, except on the Sabbath eve. Why? Well, so that they would have to trust God every single day. Morning and evening, they had to trust God to provide every day. He didn't provide for them one day and then the other 365 days, he did 364, he didn't provide. That they only have to trust it. We only have to trust God one day a year. Is that how it works? No. Every day he's teaching them, trust me to provide for you. Especially on a Friday, when they got twice as much because there wouldn't be any on the Saturday or the Sabbath. Is that a lesson we need to remember today? What is it you need to trust God about? What is it you need him to supply for you? What is it about today or tomorrow or next week or next month or next year? God provides every day. He's asking you to trust in him today. You know, it's quite hard for us, I think, as mainly Western Christians, to understand this, to ever worry about being thirsty or hungry. Now, I'm sure you've been thirsty and hungry, but have you ever worried about the next chance you're going to be able to quench that thirst or feed that hunger? We have a lot, don't we? Those basic needs are very easy for us to take care of, most of us, to take care of ourselves in that. We become quite self-sufficient. And in the culture we live on where we have so much plenty, it can be hard for us to learn this lesson, to trust God. But there are things we need God to do for us. We need to trust him to provide for us. Will God provide for me as I face being made redundant? Will God provide for me when I'm running out of money and I've got things to pay for? Will God provide for me when I'm facing a really difficult situation and I'm in need of strength and wisdom and patience to get through it? Will God provide strength and power to me when I'm facing temptation and can't overcome sin by myself? Will God provide? What is your need? Because you must trust God that he can provide. I think this is what God is showing his people. He's literally just saved them from slavery in Egypt. He's not going to fail them now that they're in the desert. Listen to this verse in Romans chapter 8, verse 32. It'll be familiar to you, but just think about this, the implications of this verse. Romans 8, 32. He who did not spare his own son, but gave him up for us all, how will he not also along with him graciously give us all things? God has provided our greatest need, as we've already been thinking about this morning, our salvation through Jesus. Will he not also provide every other lesser need? Will you trust God to provide, or will you, like the Israelites, fail to trust him and still try and maybe do it yourself, live life without God, without prayer, with totally just sort of relying on yourself every day? And that brings us to a third and perhaps the most important lesson from the desert. It teaches us to trust and obey. Listen to Deuteronomy 8:3 again. God humbled you, causing you to hunger and then feeding you with manna, which neither you nor your fathers had known, to teach you that man does not live on bread alone, but on every word that comes from the mouth of the Lord. God wants his people to trust him in the wilderness. But for them to really express that trust, to demonstrate that trust, they had to obey. Only by following his word would they make it through. We saw this even in chapter 15, verse 25, where God promises to protect and heal them if they keep his word. In verse 4 of chapter 16, God promises bread from heaven in order to test them and see whether they will follow my instructions. So on the Sabbath, that Saturday, there would be no food. They had to collect twice as much the day before. It was a test. Will they trust him to provide enough and obey that Sabbath command to rest? Or will they go out looking for food? Well, apparently some of them didn't trust God enough in verse 27, and they do disobey. And in verse 28, God says, how long will you refuse to keep my commands and my instructions? If you're going to trust God, do what he says. That's a great way of demonstrating trust in God. To trust what he says, to do what he says. This summer, I was on a youth camp in Wales, and one of the activities was high ropes. I don't know if you've come across high ropes before, basically climbing up into trees and trying to get from one tree to another on nothing but a rope and a safety wire, maybe. And we had some of these kids, some of them were tiny kids, really. It was a teenage camp, but they were tiny, some of these kids, climbing up these ropes, and it was terrifying. But they all got through. But it was what was really important for these kids to do was to listen to the instructor. He said, if you're going to get through this course, you need to do these things. Now, they could have got up there and thought, you know, I think I can think of a better way of doing it. Well, they'd be risking a lot, wouldn't they? No, to get through the course, well, they needed to do as the instructor had told them to do. It's only by trusting God, following his word, that the Israelites would make it to the promised land. Trusting God is the way through the desert life. Trusting and obeying him, walking in step with the Spirit. Now listen, we sometimes think it is bread we need. Material things, worldly things, but it is really God we need. We need to trust and follow him. Following Jesus in this world, in this desert we called life, means obedience. Now listen, this is important. We don't obey God in order to kind of, you know, get things from him. We don't obey God in order to save ourselves. You know, look at me, I'm such a good Christian, Lord, doing all the right things. It's not something we earn. Israel, remember, Israel were already saved. He'd already brought them through the Red Sea. They were done, they were saved. No, obedience is how we respond to the grace we've been shown, the love God has already shown us. Some of you here who are, I'm thinking particularly of Christians, but not necessarily, who are not walking in obedience to Jesus. You're still trying to do it your way. You know what you should do, but you won't do it. It seems too hard. Seems too risky, there's too much effort, you just don't want to. You want to control your life, you want to hold on to those things that you've got. You don't want to give up that sin. You think that life is found in bread. You think that life is found in living life the way you want, but it's found in trusting and obeying God. So hear this warning of the desert. Do not harden your hearts in unbelief that leads to rebellion and disobedience. Trust Jesus and follow what he says, and you will live. Now listen, we all fail to do that.
I fail to do that. To trust and obey.
But there's one who never did. The Lord Jesus Christ. In fact, during Jesus' earthly life, Jesus was tempted not to trust in God and to disobey his Father. He was in a wilderness. He was in a desert. Literally, in fact. And in that desert, you can read about this, Luke 4, Matthew 4. Jesus in the middle of a desert being told, Jesus, don't listen to your Father. Do it your own way. What does Jesus do? He quotes Deuteronomy 8, verse 3. You know this, right? He said, man shall not live by bread alone, but every word that comes from the mouth of God. Living is not having more bread. Living is trusting God and following his word. Jesus knew it, and he did it. And this leads us to the final thing, really, I want to show you today, the true bread from heaven. In John chapter 6, Jesus calls himself the bread of heaven. And that wasn't an accident. He's deliberately comparing himself to the manna in Exodus chapter 16. So here it is. Here's what he says on the screen. I tell you the truth, John 6. He who believes has everlasting life. I am the bread of life. Your forefathers ate the manna in the desert, yet they died. But here is the bread that comes down from heaven, which a man may eat and not die. Verse 51, I am the living bread that came down from heaven. If anyone eats of this bread, he will live forever. This bread is my flesh, which I will give for the life of the world. Jesus is the ultimate provision of God for you. He's the one you need the most. Not bread, you need him, the bread of life, the living bread. Jesus gave his life to save yours. He took on himself all of your rebellion, all of your grumbling, all of your disobedience. He took it all on himself, and he was punished in your place. He suffered the wrath in your place so that you don't ever have to. And instead, what you receive is cleansing and forgiveness and mercy and grace. We're going to think more about this tonight. And it washes over us. We don't get what we deserve. As grumbling, disobedient people, we get mercy. We get grace and love because of what Jesus has done for us in sacrificing himself for us. And more than that, if that wasn't enough, more than that, he now promises and gives you, by his Holy Spirit, his very presence in your life. So that he himself is with you right now in this desert we call life. You're not alone. He is with you by the Spirit to provide for every need, to guide and care, protect. I don't know what you're facing in your desert at the moment. But may I encourage you to know that Jesus is Lord. God is God. He's got this. Know that he is more than able to provide all that you need in this life to get you through. And know that trusting and obeying him is the key. Maybe you've never done that. Maybe you've never trusted in Jesus Christ. Maybe you're still, as the Bible would call you, slaves of sin. You're still a slave in Egypt, so to speak. You're still living as a slave to sin. You're struggling to face the challenges of life in this desert. You're living maybe for earthly, material, monetary things, the big house, the nice car, the right lifestyle, the right family, and it's exhausting. You think it's bread you need. But maybe today you need to see that it is Jesus, the bread of life, you need the most. And so I encourage you, I urge you, I plead with you to trust in him. Trust in him, maybe for the first time. Trust that he can free you from sin. He can forgive you, and he can come into your life and carry you through this journey.